Now on BBC Radio 4, Simon Evans presents another series of Jokenomics, or is it Economedy? This series focuses on our addictions. You might want to top up before we begin. We're starting with alcohol.
Welcome to Simon Evans Goes to Market. Thank you and welcome to Simon Evans Goes to Market. If you missed the first series, don't worry. A few hours with Adam Smith, Thomas Piketty and the Puffin Joke Book will bring you right up to speed. This time around, we're going to look at the markets in human weakness. Alcohol, sugar, coffee and tobacco. Now, I know you think economics is boring and that you're too stupid to understand it, but actually, only one of those things is true. Yes. Even a cursory understanding of economics can help you see how the world works and could change your life, possibly even for the better. For example, if only Alanis Morissette had grasped the principles of trade, she wouldn't have minded that she had 10,000 spoons when all she needed was a knife. Out there was someone else with half a ton of knives and a bowl of soup that was going cold. Even Alanis, with her poor grasp of irony, could surely see that she was in a strong bargaining position. She cornered the spoon market, which, given the angle-free geometry of the spoon, really is ironic. However, this episode is not about spoons, but alcohol and how economics might help our understanding of our relationship with it. Alcohol itself, of course, needs no introduction, and nor do you, it seems, if you've had a few. Many of us, a drink remains the easiest way to dissolve the inhibitions that can prevent us from making a right tit of ourselves. No wonder it's popular, with 85% of us enjoying at least the occasional snifter. Now, alcohol has certainly assumed a central, if supporting, role in many of our lives, and yet some people have managed to resist its siren call, lashing themselves to the mast rather than going out on the lash. I wanted to use one as a guinea pig, and one of them, incredibly, is in the employ of the BBC and is with us tonight. Our series guinea pig, Andy, ladies and gentlemen. Now, Andy is teetotal, pretty much. Is that right, Andy?
Christmas, I'll have a sherry, which I won't like.
You've been making yourself at home with the complimentary nuts and savoury snacks, I believe?
Yep.
Excellent. So hopefully you'll be starting to understand the economics of complimentary snacks, which is that you now have a raging thirst, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to start you off with a nice glass of red wine, whose tannins and flavonoids are universally acknowledged to be a good thing, and which, if drunk in moderation, reduce the risk of stroke, Alzheimer's and sadness.
Thanks.
You're welcome. That'll be £12.80, please, if you can just pop it on the table. Don't feel too ripped off, however. You have there got what is now known in pubs as a large glass, which is, size-wise, basically a bottle with the neck sawn off. So one of many clever little tricks that the pubs have pulled on us lately.
Do you want me to sort of give you tasting notes with the sort of the flowers and woody tastes?
Yeah, righto. Just get it down your neck, son. When you've had that, you can chase that down with a few lagers or a craft beer. It's only a half-hour programme, however, so later on, when you start to feel a bit bloated, we'll move you on to shorts, OK? You have a seat there and try not to get into any fights. So, I like a drink as much as the next man, which is to say 11.6 litres of pure alcohol per year. And the day I learned to spread that out a bit over the whole 12 months was one that saved my life. Those litres all add up, however, and the value of the UK drinks industry is a cool £38 billion. It's also a massive export business, especially whisky, which accounts for 67% of the off-island trade and fully a quarter of all UK and food drink exports. Incredible to think of those 99 million cases of whisky, all distilled and bottled using traditional methods by crinkly-eyed old Scotsmen with wiry forearms and plenty of intra-leg ventilation. Incredible and woefully inaccurate, of course. Most of it is mass-produced in factories. But the Scots trade very successfully on the heritage of their product, and quite right too. I always like to know what I should be picturing when I close my eyes and savour a single malt. And it isn't a sales graph in the head office of Diageo. For that privilege, we pay £329 each per year in tax to the Exchequer, who subsequently get their round in the form of police, A&E and Trident to keep us safe while we sleep it off. 57% of the cost of a bottle of wine is tax, which is why I make sure I only drink the top half. There is an economic hangover associated with all this fiscal merriment, and it's vicious. Alcohol-related harm is now estimated to cost society £21 billion annually in England alone, and this figure is made up. Sorry, this figure... this figure is made up of NHS costs, alcohol-related crime and lost productivity due to alcohol, though it doesn't even cover the financial ramifications of getting drunk and waking up in Las Vegas married to a blackjack dealer called Amber. The overall cost of the NHS alone is £3.5 billion, and alcohol is one of Britain's three biggest lifestyle risk factors for disease and death after smoking and onesies, or more technically obesity, though I would argue that correlation in this case does equal causation. Worldwide, meanwhile, alcohol-related premature deaths account for 3 million a year, more than measles, malaria and men in balaclavas combined. So what is it that blurs our vision when we examine our glasses for traces of guilt? Follow the money is this show's default position, and to help me find out where it's going and, frankly, whether we can get a slice of it, is our in-house economist. Please welcome from Radio 4's More or Less, the man with a golden calculator, Tim Harford. Tim, are economists fond of a drink? Is it a drinking profession?
We're not actually famous as party animals. The saying goes that when the economics conference arrives in town, all the hookers take the week off.
Obviously, it's quite easy, as I did earlier, to enumerate the costs of alcohol to society, but it's harder to economically assess the benefits it brings.
It's tricky for economists because we always assume that if you bought something, you've bought that hamburger, you've bought that holiday, you've bought that book, it must have given you some pleasure, it must have been worth it for you. But once you get to harmful and addictive substances, and alcohol's certainly one of those, it gets much more tricky to still assume that people are acting rationally, and we're not so good at that.
It's very difficult because this is a product that's been in society for a very long time. Alcohol has been around, I mean, in the case of a bottle of limoncello in our larder, about 23 years. Even the cleaner won't touch it. But it's mentioned, of course, in the Bible. Noah celebrates hitting dry land by getting drunk in his own vineyard. Jesus' first miracle was to turn water into wine at the wedding of Cana, which is surely, I think, a ringing endorsement of alcohol's ability to make even weddings endurable. And broadly speaking, a sign that God is clearly pro-booze. He gave us grapes. And then the Romans came at one point with their wine.
They did. They discovered this massive economic benefit of wine, which is while you're subjugating peoples across an enormous empire, you can sort of get them to view you in a favourable light by supplying them with Chianti.
And right.
They pay their taxes and they're perfectly happy. If you can grow grapes, then, you know, you make wine.
We don't have grapes in this country, of course, so we
So we were forced to resort to apples and cider, which is okay, honey, mead, and then, thank goodness, we eventually discovered how to make beer.
Beer, absolutely, because cider is far too easily drunk by children without wincing, and very fair to say as well, and this is important, it was for centuries, again around the world, the only safe way to drink anything at all. Water could often be contaminated, but small beer, as it was called, which is only about 2 or 3% alcohol, was actually safer than fresh water and was the main thing that was drunk. Labourers would drink 10 or 12 pints of the stuff over the course of a day just to slake their thirst. How very different from modern Britain. But the fact is, people live their whole lives ever so slightly sozzled. And the economic advantages of this, I would say, were massive because life was rubbish for everyone back then, and this got them through it. And the British wobbled happily through many centuries on 2 or 3% alcohol, this kind of small beer, before the first spirits began to appear. I believe they came over with William of Orange from Holland. Is that right?
Yeah, hence the term Dutch courage, because the Dutch invented gin. And William was in favour of gin. William is trying to suck up to Parliament, all the parliamentarians, own land, and will profit from a rise in the price of grain. So two birds with one stone. You ban the import of French brandy, and you encourage the British to distill their own bathtub gin from British grain, and grain prices go up. What could possibly go wrong with that? I have an account here of the time. An eyewitness wrote, the whole town of London swarmed with drunken people from morning until night. It was so appalling that the Daily Mail apparently was set up in order to be appalled by it.
Now, you may be looking at your post-work glass of wine and thinking, oh, come on, it's not that bad. And you're probably right, unless you're listening to this in your car, in which case you should definitely switch to a hip flask. It's much less detectable in a moving vehicle than a glass of Rioja sloshing about every time you try to answer the phone. That's just a little personal tip, not BBC endorsed. We've seen that alcohol is one of the leading causes of premature death and has brought one of the world's greatest cities to its knees. So the question is, how is alcohol still allowed to walk the streets, twirling its cane and tipping its hat to small children and scandalised ladies, while these other pharmaceutical ne'er-do-wells must skulk in the shadows and profit the criminal rather than the licensed trade and the exchequer? To get to the bottom of this, I met David Nutt, world-renowned professor of neuropsychopharmacology. Try saying that after a few pina coladas at the World Science Expo. He was famously sacked from the government's advisory council on the misuse of drugs after he said that alcohol was more harmful to society than LSD, cannabis or ecstasy. He was clearly right, to be fair. The only threat ecstasy users present to society is unwanted sweaty hugs, gurning and Manchester. Even cocaine users offer very little danger to passers-by, at least if you don't actually have any tits to be bored off in the first place. I met David Nutt at a pub, which gradually emptied, bizarrely, as we went on. He ordered the Diet Coke and I gingerly looked at an untouched pint while he told me just how dangerous alcohol really is.
If we treated alcohol like we treat food additives, for instance, or food colourants, and we do proper toxicology testing and we say, how much of this is safe to use in a year, the amount of alcohol you could drink in a year would be about one glass of wine. And that shows you the magnitude of the blinkers we put on ourselves, because we allow ourselves to drink 1,000 times more than the safe dose.
That is extraordinary, because I had seen widely reported that a glass or two of red wine a night is better than nothing at all in terms of health.
Yeah, well, this is one of the wonderful pieces of misinformation that the drinks industry puts out. Alcohol overall is extremely damaging. There is no age in which alcohol consumption, either in men or women, it has a net benefit in our society. And alcohol in young people is particularly damaging. Alcohol is the leading cause of death in men between the ages of 16 and 50. And in another 10 years, it'll be the leading cause of death in women of that age. Because it is so destructive in terms of the liver damage it causes and also the disinhibited behaviour and the accidents and the fights, etc.
But are you factoring in the ability to feel the love towards your fellow man, that kind of lovely warm feeling gathering around there?
That's the first point. And then, of course, you start beating up your fellow man after the sixth point.
Just as well he's on the Diet Coke. But why is it still then so popular? I wonder, because is it about money? I'd always assumed the reason that alcohol is allowed to remain in our culture, protected by government, is that they get significant revenues from it themselves.
Well, this has always been the argument. And, of course, the revenue they get is a pretty immediate revenue. So it's a steady influx of maybe 10, 12 billion pounds a year into the Treasury. The problem is that the costs of alcohol outweigh the benefits. Certainly, if you look at the cost to policing in Britain, now that's estimated up to about 8 billion a year. The health costs about 4 billion.
Sorry, are you saying 8 billion of policing specifically to deal with drugs?
To deal with alcohol, yeah. Well, it's the social disorder on our streets on Friday and Saturday nights is so enormous. Yes, it costs between 6 and 8 billion a year to police drunkenness.
And I should clarify, when Professor Nutt says to police drunkenness, he means policing drunk people, not actual police drunkenness. Police drunkenness actually accounts for no more than a couple of billion a year, and that is mainly spent on donuts to soak up the hangover. So what I did want to know is what economic weapons we might have in our arsenal to help us cope with this flood of drunkenness.
We know what to do, because another country called France, 30 years ago, did it right. They stopped all alcohol advertising. They reduced the drink driving limit to 50 milligrams percent. We have 80. And they priced out, through minimum pricing, cheap wine. That reduced cirrhosis death rates in France to 20% of what they were 40 years ago. When I started in medicine, liver cirrhosis was the French disease, along with syphilis. Now, we have death rates from cirrhosis that are 3 times those of the French, and the Scots have death rates 6 times those of the French.
I think this is interesting, because we have always accepted in this country that the French have this almost preternaturally balanced and healthy relationship with alcohol, just because they're somehow more sophisticated and they start drinking at the age of 4 and they eat their meat and their beans separately and all this sort of nonsense. But actually, it didn't just happen, it took legislation. Tim Harford, you've heard what David has to say about booze. To be fair, he is a neuropsychopharmacologist, possibly the only one in captivity. You are an economist. Do his suggestions for limiting the ravages of alcohol stand up as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think he's absolutely right that if you raise the price of booze, then people are going to drink less. That stands to reason, and we've also got good evidence on that. What's a bit strange, though, is this idea that we have of a minimum price for alcohol. That's really strange. So you can make Diamond White more expensive by saying there's a minimum price, or you can make Diamond White more expensive by putting more tax on it. And if you put tax on it, then the government gets the money and gets to spend it on public services. If you just put a minimum price on it, then the pubs or the supermarkets get the money. It's really strange. If they got together and they said, we're going to agree a minimum price for booze, they'd go to prison, and yet the politicians are suggesting that they introduce a law forcing them to do that.
We're not the only country that have struggled with this over the years. Who are the big drinkers?
It's disappointing, isn't it? No, the champions are all former Soviet Union countries.
So right.
The Soviet bloc had supplied 8 out of the current 10 top drinking nations.
Wow.
It's a real record to be proud of. So Russia in particular, they've been trying to control vodka in Russia for a very, very long time, and it's always been a bit tricky because vodka tax revenues, before there was oil and gas to prop up the Russian state, it was being propped up by tax on vodka. In the 19th century, it apparently accounted for over half of all state tax revenue.
That is a lot. So how are they dealing with it at the moment? I mean, where are they at?
Well, I think they're all still drunk. I mean, the most remarkable attempt, I think, came in the late 1980s. You may remember Mikhail Gorbachev with his policy of glasnost. As well as glasnost, he also had a policy of trying to promote sobriety, trying to get people to cut down on the drink. He did actually manage to reduce official vodka sales. Unfortunately, the sales of sugar surged, and by a fantastic coincidence, it turns out that sugar is the key ingredient of moonshine. In Russia, it's called samagon. So yeah. Pretty soon, people were not only blind drunk, but actually literally blind and mad as well.
So in Russia, if they put the price up too high, people just start distilling their own spirits, essentially. That's the...
Yeah, and this is something that we found all over the place. So America famously tried prohibition. They didn't really get rid of alcohol, but they did encourage the mafia to set up. So it didn't really work out too well. I mean, there is this long-standing idea in economics of the bootleggers and the Baptists. So you ask yourself, who wants alcohol to be banned? And one group of people are the Baptists, because they're fine, upstanding citizens. They think alcohol is terrible. And the other people who want alcohol to be banned are the people who make illegal alcohol. People standing up for the regulation for ethical reasons, but also the people who would actually profit from the loopholes also want the regulation, because that's how they can make money.
That's interesting. Let's go and check, how are you doing, Andy? Can I just ask, you've had your wine, how are you getting on with the wine? You haven't made much of a dent in it, I have to say.
Well, it doesn't taste very nice for a start.
One large gulp out of that and then move on to that craft beer that we've got sitting there. I'm a bit suspicious of the craft beers. I think craft has its place, usually in a market or something, you know, but I'm not sure beer should be made with love. I think know-how is more important, personally, but you have a glug of that, see how you get on. Now, there is one drink... Whoa! More craft went into the making of it than the pouring of it, by the way. There is one drink I won't be giving to Andy this evening after a long discussion with the producer, which is a shame, to be honest, because it's an entirely legal beverage that I've been... Could you stop upstaging me with your froth antics over there? It is a shame because it's an entirely legal beverage that I've long been intrigued by, and yet I am unwilling to sample myself. And I think it illustrates some of the economic imperatives that actually determine our consumption of alcohol. The drink in question is known by many names, particularly in the parts of Scotland where it's popular. Rec the Hoose Juice, Commotion Lotion, and Cumbernauld Rocket Fuel. But its official title is Buckfast Tonic Wine. Shortened often to Bucky, and it's made and sold in Buckfast Abbey in Devon by monks. Now, These monks, played in your head by Bill Bailey or Derek Nimmo, depending on age... basically, buy the cheapest red wine available from the continent's industrial drip trays and beef it up with what amounts to a highly caffeinated cough syrup. Bucky is then, in theory, sold up and down the country to those in need of a little pick-me-up before their evening meal, but is in practice mostly driven straight to the off-licences and supermarkets serving the less well-off parts of Lanarkshire. Where it is widely held to be responsible for a substantial proportion of Scotland's violent crime, or certainly that which occurs within what is known as the Buckfast Triangle, which is a bit like the Bermuda Triangle, but instead of planes disappearing, it's entire weekends. And yet, despite the church's long and distinguished history of campaigning against intemperance of any kind, the monks of Buckfast have taken a very selective vow of silence on the role their product plays north of the border. They have wound their sales pitch in a little lately. The label used to recommend 3 small glasses a day for good health and lively blood. So lively, it often leaps entirely clear of your body and is found... pooling in a gutter with several teeth bobbing about in it. However, the label now states the name tonic wine does not imply medicinal or health-giving properties and will surely lead soon to a label that simply reads Buckfast Tonic Wine, do not drink. To paraphrase the National Rifle Association, Bucky doesn't kill people, people kill people. Especially people on Bucky. Except, of course, that Bucky does kill people too. It kills many of its users, as do all alcoholic beverages. Bucky and the other alcoholic drinks take the lives of incomparably more users than heroin, cocaine and every other illegal drug known to man combined. So, I'm sorry, Andy, we can't offer you any Bucky anyway. We just couldn't get the insurance. But I want to find out now how you're getting on economically. How do you feel about your job right now? How do you feel about the fact that you are a BBC wage slave?
I feel very warm.
Warm towards your employer, towards your colleagues?
Yeah, it's like a mixture of feeling quite chilled out but also nauseous. But yeah, I feel good about my job. This has been a good day at the office.
Yes, well, that's great. Sadly, I can tell you that due to your turning up to work drunk, you no longer have a job. I'm really... zero tolerance at the BBC, I'm afraid. So you're in a good position to drown your sorrows. May I recommend the brandy? So... Andy there demonstrating the double-edged sword of alcohol, that the idea that it might be possible to enjoy the benefits of alcohol but avoid the pitfalls, such as being laid off, has long been cherished by mankind. But is that idea, that alcohol could ever be tamed, is that a complete fantasy? When I spoke to David Nutt, he told me that he's actually been working on a sort of synthetic substance which would have all the effects of alcohol but would also come with an antidote. And I don't mean a fry-up, I mean a real antidote. One which would return you to sobriety within an hour of your taking it.
We've identified many, many compounds that would be substitutes for alcohol, safe alternative drinks.
Are you even allowed to market them with caveats or even on prescription or anything at the moment?
Well, the position is very unclear. So my view is that we could actually sell a drink that was like alcohol perfectly legally. The problem is no one knows whether when one started doing that, the government would suddenly decide that they didn't like that and then would clamp down. So personally, I'd like to take the risk, but I need a bit of funding to do that.
So you've got the chemical, let's call it...
We call it Alcosynth.
Alcosynth. OK, sounds a bit 80s, but we'll go with it. Alcosynth, and that is, you already have the antidote. You could go to market with that right now, if you had the backing.
Absolutely. We have the product, we've tested it, we know it's like alcohol. We're ready to go, we just need investors.
What a perfect time, then, to talk to our series investment guru, Merin Somerset-Webb, about the potential for investing in Alcosynth. Unfortunately, because she's the editor of Money Week, she lives the high life up in Edinburgh, and she can't be with us here in the studio. I can't remember the exact reason she gave. It was something about J.K. Rowling and some blood diamonds. So... down the line to Edinburgh, I asked Merin if she would invest in Alcosynth, as described to me by David Nutt.
Can you drive after you've taken the antidote?
Well, he says so. He says within an hour of taking the antidote, you're completely sober to all intents and purposes, yeah.
OK, well, in that case, yes, I think it's a very interesting investment opportunity, but I suspect there's some psychological issues with it. If we took something that gave us the effects without the after effects, we would be effectively admitting that we drink to get drunk rather than drinking because we like the taste of wine, which, of course, is what we all pretend, right? We like beer, so we drink beer because we like it.
People would resist the idea that they were... socially hindered by their own personality.
Yes, I think so. And there's also the issue of, you know, joy and suffering.
And joy and suffering are, if you're wondering, the names of Merrin's children. They're quite a traditional family in Scotland. But because of where she lives, Merrin is more excited than any Money Week journalist I've ever heard about the effect that Alcosynth would have there.
If you could drink a lot and then drive, I think this would be an absolute goer of a product, particularly in Scotland, where, you know, there are new drink driving rules where you can barely drink a thing. And Scotland is full of frustrated drinkers at the moment. So I would launch this product first in Scotland.
And obviously there's now. OK, steady on, Merrin. Away from Alcosynth, I wondered whether there are any other areas where we might make money from alcohol.
You can go and look at the crowdfunding websites where you can invest in a niche gin company or a niche whiskey company.
But you certainly can. But would you recommend them? Are they proving to be profitable?
It's very early in the cycle for crowdfunding, so it's impossible to say yet. But generally, small companies fail, so probably not.
But if one takes off, you're in right at the bottom.
Well, exactly, and that's the way with investing in very small companies. If they do well, they do really well, but mostly they don't. But it's fun, and it's a lot more interesting.
Now,
is it going to finance your pension? Probably not.
Good job. I've got my stash of vintage wines in the cellar then, ready to sell on in a few years' time when this Radio 4 gravy train pulls to a shuddering halt. I asked Merrin if it was worth investing in some more bottles of wine.
Investing in wine is great as long as prices go up. You're making a big assumption there, and yeah. You know, we always say that nothing is an investment unless it's paying you an income. If it's paying you an income, then you can figure out what it's actually worth, because you take the present value of the future streams of income and you say that's what this thing is worth today based on my forecast of the income it's going to produce. If it doesn't have an income, it's impossible to find what its correct value is at the moment. That makes it not really an investment but a hobby.
Well, I've already got a hobby that's detrimental to my health and doesn't guarantee much of an income, namely this series. So... what have we learned? We learned that 50% of a bottle of wine is tax, unless you get it from Tesco, in which case it's mostly old Ribena and food colouring. We've learned that if your street is plagued by hookers, maybe the best thing to do is host an economics conference. In the 18th century, gin probably didn't taste as nice as it does now, but it was much better for cleaning your paintbrushes. The Russians drink so much that it's possible that their incursion into Ukraine was just a drunk tank driver who'd thrown his sat-nav at a bouncer. And finally, LSD is less harmful to society than red wine and will make for a much punchier coq au vin. Thank you very much for listening. I've been Simon Evans. Thank you and good night. To Simon Evans Goes to Market, where I was joined by Tim Harford, Professor David Nutt, and Merrin Somerset Webb. It was written by me, Simon Evans, with Benjamin Partridge and Andy Walton, and Guy Venables, and the producer was Claire Jones. It was a BBC Radio comedy production.
And you can join Simon at the same time next week when he's looking at the economics of our relationship with tobacco.